There is this thing. Do you realize what is important? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. This is CKUT on 90.3 FM, broadcasting live from Montreal. My name is Amy Lloyd.
And I'm Maya Bitson.
Today we broadcast from the Jodiake, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe Nations. The time now is 5:02.
Today we have an interview with Professor Gregory Mickelson, who is a tenured associate professor at the McGill School of Environment and Department of Philosophy. He has taught both higher and lower level philosophy, biology, and environment courses, with research specializing in the philosophy of environmental studies, economic equality, and ecological communities. Professor Mickelson has recently been making headlines over his decision to resign from McGill, effective next week, due to the board's decision over not divesting from fossil fuel investment. For those who don't know, divestment is the process of selling off subsidiary business interests or investments, in this case, shares in companies mining oil, gas, coal, and the likes. Today we're talking to Professor Mickelson about his decision to resign, McGill's governance and climate crisis awareness, and how higher institutions can make a difference regarding environmental activism. Before that, we have the remaining few minutes of our Bill 21 feature from last week, as well as a few songs and our weekly headline roundup. We're super excited to have Professor Mickelson on our show today, so stay tuned for that interview later on.
See it when he talked to me, his eyes closed like windows. Watch the seasons and they made me see the time when I could still hope. We could be clear in anger, we could take fear and sing her a song and show her. He wasn't trying to be this way, but he couldn't see through all the feelings that I tried to heap on him. Made it hard to tell if it was my own voice, tell if it was the right choice. Curled up in a ball, instead of bad. How can I be true to him? How can I be true instead of sad? Or is this all I have? Or is this all I have? Upon this floor like the night when I met him, but it was just How can I be good to him? How can I be good instead of bad? How can I be true to him? How can I be true instead of sad? Or is this all I have?
So that was Good Instead of Bad by Dana Gavansky. The time now is 5:06. Now for our weekly headline roundup.
The Parti Québec Solidaire is calling on the Legault government to spend more of its tax surpluses on bettering government services and raising the wages for public sector workers. According to the Montreal Gazette, quote, the Coalition Avenir Québec government is sitting on a $1.7 billion surplus for the 2019-2020 fiscal year. The co-spokesperson from Quebec Solidaire said it's time to open up that tap, unquote. Manon Mace, a QS co-spokesperson, issued a statement saying, quote, if the economy is going well, if the treasury is full, then everybody must benefit from these collective efforts of the past. Quebecers were asked to tighten their belts for years. Our government services now must meet the people's expectations, unquote. However, the QS's agenda, unfortunately, does not coincide with the vision of the CAQ government. Finance Minister Eric Girard issued a statement as well saying, quote, this surplus will be used to deal with potential economic slowdown, fight climate change, and reduce debt, unquote. Another spokesperson for the QS, Gabriel Nadeau-Dubois, said that, quote, we will have concrete proposals for the government to put money where the needs are on the ground. I think wealthy people in Quebec have had a lot of tax cuts in the past. I don't think this is a solution. People don't want $100 or $150 tax cut a year. They want to have strong public services. They want access to hospitals. They want access to well-funded public schools with enough teachers in them, unquote. However, on the bright side, Quebecers will experience an increase in refunds from Hydro-Quebec for overcharging. According to Montreal Gazette, quote, the original amount was $500 million and now it will be $535 million, unquote.
The McGill Office for Sexual Violence Response, Support, and Education will be offering two groups for students during the winter term. The office is set to run first a support group for students who identify as a sexual or a gender minority to unpack the intersections between queerness and trauma. The six-session group will be on Wednesdays from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. starting February 5th. Assessments will be conducted with interested students prior to the group start date. The office will have three support sessions for Black, Indigenous, People of Color students coming up on February 18th, March 10th, and March 31st, all from 5 to 7 p.m. These will be punctual sessions for which students can register online. For more information, registry, or to book an appointment, students can email osvrse@mcgill.ca.
Are you doing anything this Friday at 3 p.m.? If not, you should attend the event hosted by SPHR McGill with Philosophy Associate Professor Alia Al-Sadji. The event is titled Islamophobia as Racism and will be taking place in the Institute of Islamic Studies at McGill University. The talk will actually be held in the Morris Hall, Room 017, otherwise known as the TNC Theater, in commemoration of the 2017 Quebec mosque shooting. Al-Sadji will be providing a critical phenomenology of Muslim women's racialization, along with defining Islamophobia as a form of racism. The Facebook event link will be posted on our Twitter after the show.
In 2014, activist Jennifer Paquette was protesting outside of a Montreal courthouse when she was violently arrested by a policeman. The demonstration, which was taking place in May of that year, was for International Workers' Day. The protest was declared illegal because organizers refused to give policy or an itinerary. Under a city bylaw, which has since been abandoned, protesters were fined if organizers failed to provide said itinerary. Paquette was warned by a police officer that she could be rearrested, which she's been arrested multiple times before, if she continued demonstrating that night. As she returned to a parking lot after protesting regardless, Constable Paul Moran used excessive force, barreling into her as she stood with her hands in the air. She hit her head, lost consciousness, and was dragged by officers Moran and Ken LeBlond in front of Steve's music store, where she was detained. She sustained a head injury and a sprained neck after the accident, which she later sued the police officers responsible and the city of Montreal as well. Paquette, who is a staple at anti-capitalist and police brutality activist events, was awarded $55,000 this past May from the Quebec Superior Court judge. As of this January 17th, the Montreal police officer in question received an 8-day suspension for Paquette's violent arrest. The ethics committee ruled 5 of these days for the, quote, seriousness of his misconduct, unquote, with the other 3 days for the arbitrary arrest and 5-hour detention of Paquette that evening. Constable LeBlond was also suspended for 3 days for participating in the activist's arrest following the anti-capitalist protest. 8 days is considered a long suspension for Montreal police officers, and Paquette's lawyer has recognized this case as having served justice.
That was our weekly headline roundup. Next, we're playing the last few minutes of Noor Dawood's report on the 2-day strike against Bill 21 that began a few weeks ago. It was organized by McGill's Education Undergraduate Society. So, enjoy that.
And then the other thing that was asked of the that was asked by the organizers was the inclusion of culturally sensitive wellness resources for those who are targeted. So we see, for example, the university has been considering offering additional services for those who feel affected by the plane crash. The plane that was shot down recently. So, you know, there's no reason why similar accommodations can't be made for those who feel, frankly, scared by Bill 21. It's very difficult to get a wellness appointment at this university, as we've seen from recent conversations. But if there were resources which were specifically set aside for these students, it would make things a little bit easier on people.
Absolutely. So you're a student. I'm a student. We saw students from Concordia and UQAM and similar, you know, other universities across the province speak out against this. So, and I'm just curious from your perspective. To those who say that a 2-day student strike or however many days of a student strike might not have significant impacts on this, what do you say to that?
So, as I said, it's the start of a larger conversation. Mm-hmm. I think that this 2-day strike in and of itself doesn't reverse the bill, obviously. But I do think that leaving it up just to the courts to deal with Bill 21 is not the right move. You know, we've seen this bill come up in different iterations 3 times. So... Mm-hmm. There has to be a culture change. We have to be having conversations. University campuses are fairly progressive spaces, by and large. So one of the strategies is certainly to start these conversations on university campuses across Quebec and have them spread out into the city. For example, University du Québec à Chicoutimi is in Saguenay. You know, it's mm-hmm. something that could be a really interesting space for people to start talking about it and, you know, tell their neighbors, like, these are familiar faces. People's kids, people's neighbors can say, hey, look, like, Bill 21 is really problematic for these and those reasons and really start a social movement. Additionally, while a 2-day strike is in and of itself not a pressure tactic which forces the hand of the government, we've seen longer strikes like the 2-week internship strike or the unlimited general strike in 2012 do create significant economic disruption. And part of that is about communicating to the government that we're not going to accept the idea that the government can just systematically exclude certain people from professions and the rest of us will just not ask questions and keep filing into these jobs, right? Like, the idea is to say, hey, no, we're drawing a line in the sand, and until you accept everyone as a teacher, we're not going to help you solve your teacher shortage that exists in this province. You know, until everyone's accepted as a lawyer, we're not going to file into government and continue to represent this province, which has passed hateful legislation, frankly, against certain of its citizens.
No, absolutely. And I just on that theme, or rather the issue of conversation, of beginning a conversation, and just my final question is that during the federal election a few months back, candidates, including our currently elected prime minister, did not want to engage in discussion about CAC's bill, suggesting that it's a provincial matter. What are your thoughts on that? And or how do we begin a discussion when our you know, nation's leader is not open to it?
So I think that the discussion has to happen on various levels. As I already referenced, there's a sort of societal conversation where you convince your neighbor that you know, immigrants aren't evil, basically.
Yeah.
When it comes to the federal government, there are conversations about the use of federal disallowance, which, of course, is very shied away from, because in 1943, the last time the federal government blocked a provincial bill, it led to a constitutional crisis. But you can start asking the question, like, if not now, when? You can start asking questions and starting conversations about the federal government being so afraid to criticize votes that it, quote, needs to get elected. You know, I mean, it's the same kind of conversation of leadership that we're discussing with François Legault. Like, these are people who know what is needed to create a better society, and if you're just pandering to votes, you're going to consistently end up with the tyranny of the majority, and that's what we're seeing with Quebec.
Adam, you're the SMU External Affairs Coordinator. Thank you so much for your time.
Sure. Thank you, North. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. You are listening to organizers and participants from Friday's demonstration protesting CAQ's discriminatory Bill 21. McGill's Education Undergraduate Society voted in favor of a two-day strike, while other actions were staged, such as picket lines and walkouts, in solidarity with education students and denouncing Bill 21. The event concluded with a rally and then a march to the Ministry of Immigration, where participants voiced their concerns, primarily that Bill 21 disproportionately impacts people who may already be marginalized.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is it. The time now is 5:17, so that was the last few minutes of the Bill 21 audio essay. We're going to play a song just before our interview with Professor Mickelson, so stay tuned.
His new song called I Feel Alive, and now it's time for our interview with Professor Mickelson, who has recently been making headlines over his decision to resign from McGill effective next week due to the board's decision over not divesting from fossil fuel investment. Today we're talking to Professor Mickelson about his decision to resign, McGill's governance, and climate crisis awareness, so we hope you enjoy. Professor Mickelson, you are a tenured associate professor at McGill. I understand that some of your research involves mainly environmental ethics, equality, and ecological communities. So do you mind elaborating on some of your areas of expertise and what you've taught in your classes?
Sure. I guess in my academic career, I have, how should we say, moved from ecological science into philosophy of science, and from there into ecological economics and environmental ethics, and now some of what I do, I guess I would describe as political ecology. And I guess one unifying thread throughout the whole thing is a concern for and a fascination with biological diversity. We share the planet with 10 million other species, and you know, they're all wonderful in their own ways. And unfortunately, as our economy has exploded, their populations have been collapsing. And I think that's basically the worst thing that's happening on Earth right now. I am very concerned to turn those trends around in the opposite direction, to where instead of having 2% fewer individuals within wild species on Earth, which is the average according to the Worldwide Fund for Nature, every year 2% fewer individuals in the average population. Instead of having 2% fewer, I think we ought to be turning that around so that we help our fellow species start to recover and maybe have 2% more every year for quite a long time until we get back to a planet in which all 10 million species, including humans, are thriving. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's just one, that's one way to describe my research and my teaching.
Right. So specifically in one of your research papers, which was published in November, called Invisible Hand or Ecological Footprint, you discussed some of the key indicating facts proving that economic growth specifically depletes and pollutes nature far more than it benefits society. So do you mind right. elaborating on that?
Sure. So in that paper, I basically just looked at 66 countries over a 56-year period, and I looked for whether there were connections between how fast the economy was growing in those countries and how fast they were improving in terms of life expectancy, how fast they were changing in terms of income inequality. So I take life expectancy as one of the main indicators of human well-being, whereas income inequality is kind of a social level indicator of how badly things are going, right, as, mm-hmm. as the gap gets greater and greater. And then the final variable was the ecological footprint, which is probably the most comprehensive measure that we have of ecological degradation or ecological damage. And the main conclusion is that there's very little connection between how fast an economy is growing and how fast health is improving, or how fast income inequality is changing. So basically, very little connection between economic growth and social progress, but a very strong connection between economic growth and ecological devastation. So one way to put it is that economic growth is really not much good for anything except destroying the planet. Mm.
So clearly there is intersection between the disciplines of philosophy, environment, and economics. What do you think are the main moral concerns regarding environmental destruction?
Well, I mean, I think the main moral concern is that we're causing the sixth mass extinction in the history of our planet. And this is the first one that's caused by a single species. The previous ones were caused by either asteroids or, in some cases, runaway global warming. It's thought that, very rapid changes in CO2 concentrations may have caused some of the mass extinctions. But, of course, none of them were due to human activities because they were millions upon millions of years ago. Mm-hmm. So I think that is one of the main moral concerns. But then the damage that we're doing to the environment is actually strongly connected to to ways in which, you know, some humans are, let's say, mistreating others, or basically problems of social injustice. So I've written about connections between protecting the environment and expanding and protecting democratic decision making, and that's actually one reason that I decided to resign my position here at McGill, is because it was the board's refusal to divest was not only so profoundly anti-ecological, but also defiantly anti-democratic, given the strong mandate that that there is for divestment on campus. So, yeah, I think the moral concerns for me are, you know, we basically have no right to be driving our fellow species extinct, and we also have no right to be dominating and harming each other in the ways that we are. Of course, you know, the people in the countries that are doing most of the ecological damage are not the same ones that are suffering the most. So, you know, the diseases and, you know, devastation from global warming is, I think, being felt more in poor countries, at least so far, than it is from rich countries.
So, as you touched on before, we're going to segue a bit into now your resignation. So your choice has definitely been one that's garnered both support and criticism. I know that a lot of students involved in climate change groups like Divest and Greenpeace regard your resignation as a profound loss. So what has the overall reaction from the McGill faculty, counterparts, and students alike been?
Well, that's a good question about what the overall reaction is. And in terms of the reactions that I've seen or that people have conveyed directly to me, it's been overwhelmingly supportive, and I very much appreciate that from my colleagues in the School of Environment, my colleagues in the Department of Philosophy, my colleagues in our faculty association, as well as students. Yeah, I would say in terms of responses that have been conveyed to me, it's been very supportive, and I deeply appreciate that.
The McGill principal, Suzanne Fortier, recognizes divestment as an ineffective, quote-unquote, symbolic gesture. In response to your resignation, she reiterated the same phrase, saying that the university is looking at concrete action. So do you agree with this, and why do you think divestment is more concrete and or important than Fortier says it is in the case of McGill's investment portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, I think that kind of statement ignores the tremendous power that symbolic action has or can have. And in the case of divestment, research shows that it does have power, and that past divestment campaigns have pushed governments to take stronger action against, for example, apartheid in South Africa, against tobacco companies for the harms that they were causing. And, you know, the same is true of the fossil fuel divestment campaign. So it's basically the same old arguments that are being used despite having been refuted long ago. And it's very disappointing, I guess.
So as you mentioned previously, and in interviews previous to this one, you said that McGill has somewhat of an anti-democratic government system. So how come you think the university hasn't regarded the overwhelming mandate of its numerous environmental student groups when making decisions about divestment?
That is a very good question. And yeah, what is it about divestment that has made them so resistant? What's different either about the university or about fossil fuel that could explain why McGill did take a position of moral leadership when it came to divesting from South Africa several decades ago? And we at least joined other universities that were divesting from tobacco a little bit more recently. So either something has changed at the university that's made it more resistant to that kind of thing in general, or there's something special about fossil fuel. Maybe, I was just walking into my building, the Leacock building, and I noticed a plaque outside describing major donors that had contributed to the renovation project that's happening now. And lo and behold, one of them was Suncor, which is the top tar sand company, and it's also McGill's top fossil fuel investment. We have over $7 million invested in Suncor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe there's something there.
In a similar vein, I feel like a lot of students have been angered by the McGill's board's decision regarding divestment, and just because of the actual decision itself and because they feel like they don't have a voice in it. So how do you think McGill's Senate can communicate and gain a better relationship with the students and faculty and staff?
How do I think the McGill Senate can gain a better relationship with the community? Well, that's a good question. I mean, the McGill Senate did overwhelmingly support the divestment motion that came to it in September of 2018. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, the Senate has kind of followed the general thrust of the community. That was a rare event, though, because the Senate is tightly controlled by the central administration, and they did try in many ways to suppress the divestment motion. They happen to have failed in that case, but I think probably with regard to most things, they succeed in steering things the way they want. So I guess in terms of making the Senate more responsive to the will of the McGill community, I think the Senate has to be democratized. For example, we need to be electing our chair, the person to chair the Senate meetings, instead of having it be automatically the principal. We need to be electing basically everybody on the Senate and all for all the positions within the Senate. Right? So one general way to put it is that it may be that in order to divest McGill, we have to democratize McGill.
Understand. So climate change activists and SSMU senators and students have been accusing McGill's board of greenwashing, which is, as you know, conveying a false impression or providing misleading information about environmental sustainability. Do you think this is true, or do you think that the McGill board rather truly believes that their plan is the best alternative?
That's a good question. I think what is clear is that the principal's use of the word divesting in her announcement to the university community about what the board had decided misled thousands of people. And in order to see exactly how they were misled, you actually have to dig not only into the report that the board provided to try to justify their decision, but even into the footnotes and then into the sources of those footnotes to discover just what is the difference between divestment and decarbonization. So in this context, divestment has meant either a university selling off all of its stock in the top 200 fossil fuel companies, or at the very least, some subset of those companies, like all the tar sand companies or all the coal companies. That's what divestment means. Now, what the board is calling decarbonization instead is based on their definition of a company's carbon footprint. And the carbon footprint does not include anything that happens after a product is sold. So what that means is that fossil fuel companies in particular are off the hook for all of the harm done by, you know, burning their product, right? For all the greenhouse gas emissions that are caused. And that makes it a very striking contrast with tobacco. So we divested from tobacco precisely because of the harm caused by use of tobacco companies' product, namely cigarettes. But we're now letting fossil fuel companies off completely off the hook for the much greater harm caused by use of their product, namely fossil fuel. And one final way to put it is that the whole point of divestment is to keep most fossil fuel in the ground, because if we burn more than about 20% of it, things are going to get unimaginably worse. We already have a continent on fire, and if we get 2, 3, 4 degrees of global warming, it's basically impossible to imagine how bad it's going to get, but we know it's going to get very bad. That's the whole point of the divestment movement, is to keep most of that fossil fuel in the ground, whereas in effect, what the decarbonization commitment that McGill has made entails is that we're only going to hold fossil fuel companies responsible for pulling their product out of the ground more efficiently. For me, it was a matter of conscience, of just, you know, growing and glaring conflict between my beliefs in, you know, trying to make serious progress on the environment and also the importance of democratic governance of organizations, including universities. So the basically conflict between my commitments to those things based on my teaching and research and the behavior of the place where I work became unacceptable. That's why I did it. Now, it so happens that the media took an interest in the story, and so it has given me the opportunity to speak, you know, at CTV and CBC, et cetera. So in that sense, I hope that my resignation has had some value in basically increasing the pressure for McGill and other universities to do the right thing.
McGill is just a small part of the Canadian environmental problem, which you touched on before, I believe, and that's of adopting environmentally friendly policies while amounting a lot of our country's GDP from the fossil fuel industry. How do universities in particular contribute to federal politics and the government's mentality regarding non-renewable energy production and investment?
Yeah, well, I think universities are just an example of public institutions. And as I was saying before, divestment campaigns for public institutions to divest do have political impacts. And in particular, you know, McGill, you know, is a fairly prominent university within Canada. It's the alma mater of the Canadian Prime Minister. And when McGill divests, it will have significant political impact. So it's not a question of just the emissions that are due to our fossil fuel consumption on campus, or even the emissions that are due to the companies that we're investing in. It really is this this political context that's the most important.
Mm-hmm. A lot of large investment firms we've been seeing recently, such as BlackRock, have been taking action regarding fossil fuel management, with steps taken towards divestment. Do you think that McGill's decision will economically impair the university in the future?
I think there's a very good chance of it. And in fact, the one study that has looked specifically at the McGill endowment and how it would have been affected by divestment concluded that if the Board of Governors had done what students had asked them to back in 2013, they would have ended up $40 million richer by the end of 2015. So I think there's a good chance that this is the wrong thing economically as well as morally and ecologically. Mm-hmm. And to support that, the University of California, which has an endowment about 10 times the size of McGill's, just a few months ago, decided to completely divest their endowment as well as their pension fund. And the people managing those funds said they were doing it significantly for economic reasons.
So do you think that the benefits of your moral statement outweigh the loss on students who can no longer have you as a professor? And those are, like, particularly students who support divestment in positions of climate change. And not.
I guess that's the bet I'm taking.
Yeah.
That, you know, by leaving this place and moving on to something else, that I hope I will be able to have a positive impact on the world.
Do you think that there's any room for improvement among student climate change activism groups at McGill? Or, like, what can they do better to pressure or negotiate with the administrative body?
Beyond the general thought that in order to divest McGill, we also have to democratize it, I don't have any specific advice at the moment, but I'll be happy to continue to work informally with with the people trying to get this university to the best.
So on that similar vein, do you have any plans for the future, and how else do you think you can provide influence regarding environmental activism outside of a teaching position at McGill?
Yeah, so I have no plans beyond expanding my role as a father and in the household, et cetera, in the short term. But in the longer term, I would like to continue applying the skills in research, speaking, and writing that I've developed as a professor, and I certainly will, in whatever capacity, continue to work for positive changes with regard to the environment.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. We hope you found this interview interesting and informative. A huge thanks again to Professor Mickelson for being on our show today. Now for a few songs before we wrap up this week's episode.
Outside is cloudy, but I like that better. Behind no wheel, but still ain't on my way. Some people say they want to live forever. That's way too long, I'll just get through the day without any complications. Does it always gotta be so complicated? When I'm way too young to be getting old, and all I wanna do is look, but I can't see, baby. Who you talking to? Why you talking to me, baby? Let me know if I can see you later. We could make it easy.
invitation to. Does it always gotta? Does it always gotta? Gotta be so complicated.
Thank you.
Again, that was Complicated by Mac Miller, followed by Only You by Anemone. We want to thank our listeners for tuning in to another episode of Unfit, and you can catch us next week on 90.3 FM. Same time, starts at 5. And because he's headlining Iglyfest this weekend, we're going to be playing out Track Uno by Kate Trinata. Bye.